I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh. Hello, and welcome to our live Golster audience and our podcast listeners. I am Humphrey Hawksley. This is the Golster Magazine Show, and today we have a captivating guest who is going to cut through the jargon and explain the unexplainable in telling us about something most of us have come face to face with at some time in our lives. We are going to be recording this for our podcast for the first 45 minutes, and then we are going to cut off and open the floor to our wonderful audience to ask my guest directly whatever is on their minds. He is an emergency medical consultant, which means he knows all about A&E, and he is a pivotal figure within the NHS for making it better. Welcome, Dr. James Ray, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Thank you, Humphrey. It's nice to be here.
You don't look as if you're in a hospital.
No, I'm not. I'm working from home.
Oh.
We're in this new age where we have the ability to have Teams meetings. So it wasn't that long ago that we had to go to London or to Manchester to have meetings, but now we just do it all centrally.
And you're not one of these doctors that diagnose people from home, are you?
No. No, definitely not.
I can say I've got an ache in my shoulder, doctor, and you can tell me what's wrong with it. And we're going to talk. We've got a time here. Talk about a very serious topic that is on all our minds, I think. But when you set out to be a doctor, is this the sort of work you envisage getting into? Did you always want to be an emergency doctor?
I always wanted to work in a field that involved acute care. I think because originally I started off doing surgery when I first became a doctor. I did surgical training, and then I went into general practice, and I had that sort of generalistic approach, but I really missed the acute side of medicine. So then I then trained in emergency medicine. And when I was a junior, emergency medicine wasn't a specialty, and now it is a specialty. So in the old days of casualty, it was very much run by a lot of it was orthopedic surgeons used to run casualty in the old days. And now it's a true specialty with a Royal College, a proper training program. And each department is run and led by consultants who are fully trained in delivering emergency care.
And the orthopedic would be because people would come in with broken legs and broken arms, was it? What you do then what the Americans call a trauma doctor?
Yeah, so no, not exactly. So you'll know from listening to American TV, there's a show called ER. So ER is really what we do, but they call it the emergency room, as we call it the ER, as we call it the emergency department, ED. But a lot of people, we still use the term accident and emergency because it's still a very, it's a useful term because it's still known by the public. This is what we're here for. And in terms of trauma, a number of years ago, it was realized that you got better care in certain centers where you had the right types of clinicians. So they developed a trauma network. So there are a number of A&Es across the country which specialize in major trauma and then major trauma centers. So the hospital I work in is a major trauma center. So if you're severely injured in the street with a car or motorbike or whatever, you'll be taken. So if you've got severe injuries, you'll be taken to the nearest major trauma center as opposed to just the nearest A&E.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it's a sort of a step up from the A&E, is it?
It's a networked system. Networked
within the hospital.
Yeah. And it also works for other conditions. So if you have a stroke, for instance, you'll be taken to a specialist stroke unit, high acuity stroke unit or a HAZU, where they'll have specialist doctors who can do interventions on you to try and make you better. And likewise, for heart disease, if you have a heart attack, you'll be taken to a heart attack unit hospital as opposed to just the nearest hospital. So heart attacks, strokes and trauma, three areas where we actually have networked care. And I'm lucky that I work in a hospital with all three. So you know, and then there's other specialty, you know, vascular specialties and various other things. But if, you know, in a sort of area, so for instance, I live in Oxford, and we have Oxfordshire, Berkshire, Buckinghamshire as part of our network. But if you're in London, there's 28 emergency departments, for instance. So there's four major trauma centres in London.
Goodness. So the ambulance comes to your house and they don't go to A&E, they go straight. They warn the paramedics and everybody would know roughly, you know, what it is and would take you to the right place.
It is still an A&E, but it's just if you had a nasty road traffic accident, you'd be either taken by ambulance or by the helicopter team, the helicopter emergency medical service, the HEMS team. And the HEMS team doesn't necessarily mean they work off ambulances. They also off helicopters. They also work in cars as well. And they will take you and they will stabilize you on the scene and they'll take you to the nearest major trauma center.
Okay. That is fascinating. So what you're saying there sounds really interesting and really good. So is the NHS in as bad a state as we keep reading about in the press, or are they deceiving us?
I'm very proud of the NHS. I think it's an amazing institution service. I just think that we all struggle with how to use it and how best to use it. And one of the, you know, the four, there's a triple aim for each area, what we call ICS in the integrated care service. And one of them is, you know, preventative medicine. It's about population health and making us healthier generally. And, you know, I think that we're a very reactive nation. When we're ill, we just seek help straight away. But what we ought to be doing is really sort of almost preventing needing A&E in the first place by looking after ourselves a lot better. Muir Gray, who you know Humphrey very well, he often calls A&E the system failure service, the SFS, he calls it. And the reason is because often we serve as failure in the system because we have, you know, people who come to us with acute onsets, acute sort of exacerbations of chronic disease.
Yes.
When, you know, they come to us because they don't know where else to go in the system. And I think the challenge we have is really how do we treat people in a population level to improve health when we're doing things like stopping smoking and increasing exercise. But sometimes it's not quite in the public's understanding about how important those interventions are. As you admit into hospital, for instance, the older you are, the weaker you become, because as you admitted to a hospital bed, you start to lose muscle mass and you then get weaker and weaker, so that when you are eventually discharged from hospital, you weren't the person you were before. Your care needs can increase. So keeping people mobile and walking and exercising is so important.
That is, and are we any better or worse than, say, France, Germany, America? I mean, the whole thing that you're talking about, us keeping healthy and then the hospitals looking after us?
Yes, well, I suppose when you think of GDP and what we spend on the health service, we probably spend less than other countries. But we do have a very sophisticated and very joined up system where everything is, you know, essentially available to the public from primary to secondary care. But as I said, it just goes back to sort of understanding how to use those services better. We have services like 111. We have 111 online. We have the NHS app. We have, you know, primary care. And each primary care offer, they also have their own digital platform. So if you communicate with your GP, you can actually do that online. And it must be confusing
That is why I will jump in here, James, and say I'm going to ask you to take us through each of these so that our wonderful audience knows, and a Goldstar audience there. If you have any questions for James, any experiences, not just sort of complaining, but anything that you want to know about, put it in the chat and we will bring it into our conversation because this is such an important thing. Let's, number one, 999, what is it for and how does it work?
Yeah, that's a really, it's a vital question. So 999 is for emergencies. And it's obviously when you ring it, it goes through to the, you can have a, the fire, police and an ambulance. When you contact 999, you get assessed through by a non-clinician using a particular algorithm. And then they ask you multiple questions to work out, are you in a life-threatening state? Because their main aim is to find out whether you're either bleeding heavily, you're conscious, you've had a stroke, you're having a heart attack. So these are really key things. So they need to sort of ascertain that immediately. So they go through those questions right at the beginning. When you eventually come out the other end with an outcome and you do get an ambulance response, there are four types of ambulances that are that come out of the 999 service. There's the category one, category two, category three, and four. A cat one ambulance is for life-threatening emergencies. So if you're unconscious, you're in a cardiac arrest, you're bleeding heavily to the point that, you know, they can't stop the bleeding. These are life-threatening emergencies, and the response time is meant to be 7 minutes. But 9 out of 10, they need to make it in, they need to get to the patient within 15 minutes. Now, that is a huge ask, isn't it, in terms of every, you know, 24/7, every minute of the day. The next category is category two. So if you're having a stroke or suspecting having a heart attack, this group is the category two, and this is more like an 18-minute response time.
Is it the same vehicle or different unit?
I'll come to that in a second. Okay. It's a very good point. Okay. Because there are two types, there are multiple vehicles that are used for different responses. And then there's the urgent care ambulances, the CAT 3 and 4. So they're the longer ones. So they're 120 minutes, 180 minutes. And they're people with urgent problems that need just transport to a service that will deliver care to them. But they all come through the same line. And it's really, when you see ambulances on the streets and you see the blue lights flashing, that's probably a CAT 1 or a CAT 2. And to be able to meet the demand, so if you live in a very densely populated area or a very rural area, to be able to get to someone in 6 minutes, you have to have multiple ambulances dotted around, which they do, and then they geolocate who's the nearest to that particular problem, and they may send two or three ambulances to that one case. And I think it's a really, really important demand. So when an ambulance is then taken to hospital, it's our job to take those patients off the ambulance clinicians as quickly as possible. And we're supposed to do that within 15 minutes of them arriving. Now, if we keep those ambulances waiting, so you often hear about ambulance queuing, those ambulances are then not able to respond to those calls. So that the efficiency of the system is really key and really important to get those ambulances back on the road. It's probably the biggest risk in the whole system are those patients at home who need an emergency response and we can't respond to them. And then in terms of, you asked me about the different types of ambulances. So the big truck that everyone knows is the big transporter, but we also have ambulance cars and we have different types of clinicians that work for the ambulance service. Some will be very senior and they'll drive the cars. And they'll be the first responders into the... So if they get a category two, there'll often be a car that'll get there because they can do the initial assessment, start CPR if someone's in cardiac arrest, etc. Whereas the big truck is that right. Often comes later, and that's the transporter which takes you into hospital.
And so when we hear the stories about people waiting a day, you know, an elderly person's had a fall and had to wait a day for is that bad management or is it shortage of vehicles or what?
Well, it's a system level problem because you've got a resource, which is your number of ambulances per ambulance trust. And then you've got the fact that they've got to then respond to each of those incidents. And then there are multiple incidents. Some of them are very urgent. Some of them are not so urgent, but they still respond to them. And then you've got the issue around the hospital. So the hospital are really struggling. They've got lots of people waiting to be seen, and they can't offload the ambulances quickly enough. Then you've got this backlog of ambulances stuck in hospital. So you've seen pictures in the press of like ambulances queuing at the back of A&E.
And you'd have a sort of perfect storm of a situation where that...
Yeah.
That so that's the 999, brilliantly told. 111, what is that
for? So 111 is the number we're supposed to use for urgent problems. So problems where you don't really know the answer. You feel you're either injured, but you're not severely injured. You're unwell. You feel unwell, but you don't know what the problem is. And you want to know what to do next. And you don't know whether to go to your GP, to go to the pharmacy, go to A&E. You're in that kind of uncertain state. So you ring 111 and they put you through a series of questions based on, an algorithm. And the outcomes of that will be, it could just be advice. So they could just say, look, you just need to go to the pharmacy and get this medication. Or they may just say, you're absolutely fine. Don't worry. It'll settle down. Or it may be you need to go to hospital. Maybe you need to go to your GP. And in some areas, they can actually book you into your GP surgery if they think you're a GP type problem. But then there's also 111 online. So it uses the same algorithm, but you can do this, ask the same questions through the online platform. Okay.
Yeah, and that is a relatively new thing, 111, or has it been around for years?
It's been around for quite a long time, probably since about 2013-ish.
Okay, about 10 years or so.
Yeah.
But
it's very much different to how it was now. So they take about 19 million calls a year. I can't remember how much it was at the beginning, but it was a lot less than that. Yeah. This is really ramped up. And I think the pandemic did that, because during the pandemic, people didn't know what to do. The advice changed. Remember at the beginning, the advice changed every day. It was a new country that we couldn't travel from. Yeah. And so it was very difficult for all clinicians to be on board with all the changes. So 111 became the kind of front and center for advice. And it was after that time, I think, that people got to know what 111 really was. So I think it's become a much more useful and used service. But the frustration with it is often the fact that it takes time to get through because of the nature of lots of people calling.
Yes, and that's the whole GP situation. I was going to ask you the next question, but Angie has come in with a question along the same lines. It says, are people also, because I want to move on to the actual A&E department now, now that we've done the telephonic side of it. Angie says, and people also present an A&E with totally non-urgent conditions, medical and mental, because they are unable to get a GP appointment. It's become worse since COVID, which is what we were talking about. I waited over 6 hours to see a doctor when I fell and broke my shoulder. Many of those waiting at the A&E could have seen a pharmacist or a GP, but chose to go to A&E. Tell us, let's think about Andrew's question there, but just tell us how A&E works and how that fits into the whole thing we're talking about.
So two entry points normally in both A&Es. So either a walk-in side and an ambulance receiving area. So you need to be brought in by ambulance. But either way, you'll get an assessment once you're booked into the system. So in most A&Es, you'll walk in and you'll see a receptionist, and they'll take your details, and every person has their own unique identifiable NHS number, so take that and it'll have all your details on the system. You'll be booked in, and then you're supposed to see a clinician within 15 minutes of arrival for an assessment to work out how sick you are, because at the end of the day, the most important thing is for us to know what we're dealing with. If a man comes in clutching his chest and he's clearly having a heart attack, we want to know that pretty quickly. So that's the whole point of that initial assessment, is to work out exactly how unwell someone is. And then if you are really, really unwell, they'll take you straight into our high acuity area, which is our resuscitation area, where you'll be seen in a very different environment. If you're sort of in some departments, if you're elderly and you clearly need some investigations being done, they might put you into another area where it's lots of chairs with nurses who oversee the assessments, etc. If you're an injury, they might put you to an injury area. And if you're just someone who probably should have seen your GP, again, you'll just sit in the waiting room, and the nurse will have done your assessment, worked out exactly what your problem is and the likely investigations that are needed.
Okay. So the person that you meet in the front desk there is not a clinician, is not a nurse. That's the receptionist. And then 15 minutes later, you get a sort of a mini diagnosis.
Yeah. But since the pandemic, in our department, and this isn't the same for every department, but we have a nurse now in our reception area, and they're called a streaming nurse. So they take an initial kind of eyeball view of you. And if you're really sick, they can get you straight into the right part of the department. But the other thing that we can do now, because A&E has become a place where lots of people go for everything, we can stream you effectively to other services within the hospital. So if you come in with a pouring nose from your blood, from your nose, for instance, and you clearly need to see an ENT doctor, or if you've got an acute problem with your eyes and you've got an eye emergency, the nurse can actually, you know, call up or send you straight to the specialist within that service. And that's called streaming. And that's slightly different to that initial assessment where you work out exactly how sick someone is.
No, that's interesting. There's a couple of questions. Marion Offenbach, and she says you've answered it, but I'll read the question anyway, because it does. If when you go to E&E, i.e. not by ambulance, e.g. for suspected DVT or breathing difficulties, do you have to wait your turn or are you seen as soon as possible? Thank you. That would be the clinician would decide that within 15 minutes, I think, is what you said there, James.
Yeah.
And then Jean Joyce, when my husband collapsed with sepsis, a first responder and ambulance arrived within 20 minutes, but then was in A&E for 24 hours because there were no suitable beds. Having a bed is different from being diagnosed, is it?
Yes. So sepsis is a good example. So we have targets for sepsis. So you need to be giving fluids and antibiotics very rapidly. Someone has got acute sepsis, and we've got some diagnostic criteria. So when you come in by ambulance, the ambulance will already say to you, I suspect this person's got sepsis. They'll probably ring us through on the pre-alert phone, which is the red phone, which every ED has. And they'll say, I'm bringing in John Smith and he's got high temperature, low blood pressure. I'm worried that he's septic. So they'll go straight into our ambulance assessment area. They'll have the right blood test that you need to do for that kind of patient. They'll be given the right treatments within immediately. But then they actually sometimes, they obviously then need admitting to hospital. They won't lose out on treatment or management, but they will, unfortunately, if there's no capacity in the hospital, they sometimes wait for long periods of time in the emergency department, which is one of our big bugbears as ED clinicians. We don't like patients hanging around waiting for admission.
So although physically they're in the emergency or in the A&E thing, the hospital knows what's wrong with them. So they know how serious it is at that stage.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So don't miss out on time critical intervention or time critical medicines, etc. But the challenge we have is A&E has elastic walls, they often say, because it doesn't have any, you can just keep filling it and keep filling it.
Yes.
And we only have a certain number of nurses. If you're brought in, say, for instance, on a trolley, and you're on a trolley, you're frail, and even simple things like you need the toilet, you know, if you haven't got, you know, if you haven't got a room or an, or a place to do that, and you're being nursed by several nurses because they're trying to deal with multiple other problems. It's you know, the most important thing is that we treat people with dignity and respect that they deserve. And I think that EDs struggle with being able to deliver that when we're so full. Whereas if you go to a ward, they'll have X number of beds with X number of people in them, with the right number of nurses for each area. So it's much easier to deliver the care in a warded environment.
So you've given us a picture of A&E, and most of us would be familiar roughly with what it was and how it works and all that sort of thing. Your job, where do you sit when you go in on shift, if that's what you do, where do you sit in all of that?
That's a really good question. So there's three different areas that I sit in, and there's one I really enjoy, and there's a few that I don't. But so there's a role called the EPIC, which is the emergency physician in charge. And the EPIC is the conductor of the orchestra. So it's the consultant who knows all the patients in the department and knows who's working where, and make sure that everyone's had their breaks, make sure the patients are being cared for, and knows where the sickest patients are, actually. And then there's the, I sometimes work in resus, so I look after the patients who are critically ill or critically injured. And then sometimes I work in the ambulatory side, which is on the walk-in side where people just sit and wait to be seen. And also in the ambulance assessment area where ambulances come in and they're not always, but a high proportion of those are our older population as well. And I've actually got to a point in my career that I love that part of, right? I love talking to patients and they come in because obviously they're vulnerable, they're in need, and they've got a great story behind them. And actually hearing what they have to say, I love sort of hearing that, you know, and trying to serve their needs and also to serve them as patients, because they're anxious, they're scared, they're in an environment they're not used to. I want to get them home, so I just want to try and get them treated and sorted as quickly as I can.
So you would go out, as it were, into the front line and just chit-chat to the people that are waiting for the beds and waiting for the diagnosis and that sort of thing. How long does it take a doctor? How long does it take you to know how critically ill somebody is? I mean, can you do it just by looking at them, or do you look at their eyes?
Yeah, it's a good question. So a proportion of patients you can know by just looking at them. And then other patients, you need to look at them plus have some objective signs. They're what we call the new score, which is a combination of their blood pressure, their oxygen saturations, and these kind of things give you, and the respiratory rate, their heart rate, etc. They all give you a kind of picture of how unwell they are. And an example would be a chap came in the other day with, who is quite unwell, but his main symptom is tiredness. So really, if you're just dealing with him on the phone, he says, "I just feel tired. I can't do anything. I'm listless." It doesn't sound that serious. It just sounds fairly innocuous. But he was actually in quite a critical state. And it was only on seeing his initial blood test and his ECG that you realize how unwell he was.
What was wrong with
it? Sometimes you do need those extra things just to.
Was it a heart thing or a thing that makes when well, made
well, he was going into a state of renal failure, so his kidneys weren't working properly, and it was affecting his electrolytes, and that was contributing to the way he's feeling and his power, his muscle tone, everything. So it was interesting because as I said, sometimes you just need a little bit more information of the patients.
And as a sort of general prescriptive thing, I'll ask you for a tip. Is it good for all of us to go and have a yearly blood test, say, that check all these things out? You mentioned renal failure, but they...
Yeah, so probably everyone gets a text from their GP to say, come and get your blood pressure checked. I mean, we should be monitoring or keep at least annually checking ourselves over for our cholesterol, our blood pressure, our general health checkups. But and also... it's not just a passive thing. You've also got to actively look after your health. You see it in your parents, and you see, how could I have prevented that from happening to me? because we know that we don't know all the answers to everything. We don't know the answers to dementia, to heart disease in total. I mean, we know what the risk factors are, but we also know that people have a genetic predisposition to things, but we don't fully understand them all. And we don't know how we can affect those. But if we can look after ourselves by exercising regularly, reducing alcohol, eating well, you know, it's not rocket science. It's just...
What do we say to our GP surgery if you ring up and you want a general health check? Because they usually say, what's wrong with you? And you say, no, nothing. I just want a health check. How long does that take a GP to do? And what's the terminology we should use for that?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. I think it's a specific role that primary care offers, and there's ways that they will offer that to their patients, and it'll be bespoke depending on what surgery you're part of. But I know that GPs are phenomenally busy with so many different aspects of healthcare that they feel it a little bit overrun.
Yes.
And that's reflected on you know, the public when they try and access healthcare urgently.
If you're asking for a general health check and there's nothing noticeably wrong with you, you're going to go to the bottom of the appointment queue, aren't you?
I don't necessarily think so. I think that there'll be a certain number of appointments that GPs will deliver specifically for preventative care. But it's those urgent cases where they really struggle to fit people in, because their appointments are full of actually treating people with chronic disease, you know, with diabetes, with blood pressure issues, with heart disease. And that's what they spend a lot of their time doing, and also caring for patients at home as well. But when you've got something you just really want an answer to now, it might not be an emergency. It might not be that urgent, but to you, it's like, I need an answer now. This is where the problem arises, because there isn't a clear answer to,
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, I personally have started paying for it because I couldn't get one from the GP every 2 years. It's not cheap, and you're not quite sure what they're doing, because it's actually, tell me if I'm wrong here, when you're talking about dealing with kidney problems and blood pressure, diabetes, and that sort of thing, if that was all spotted in health checks 10 or 20 years before they become the emergency, then there wouldn't be such pressure on the NHS. Is that right?
That is right.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a system thing there that's wrong.
Yeah, prevention is definitely something we need to focus on, which is, I think, the Hewitt review, Patricia Hewitt, who did her review of the health system currently. Prevention is where we need to really focus on.
Angie has an interesting question here. What is the process for tourists? This is for A&E. Though without NHS numbers, why are they not charged for treatment at point of delivery, as we are overseas? Good point, Angie. Or referred to private clinics, freeing up capacity within the NHS. Is that a serious problem?
Yeah. So if you're an emergency or urgent, you have urgent care needs, and you're a tourist, you get free healthcare for that urgent need.
Right.
If you then get admitted to hospital and need further work, you know, further treatment, etc., then it becomes a cost implication for that person. But we deliver urgent and emergency care free.
Okay. Although if I'm in France or the States, I would have to pay for that similar stuff. Okay. Sutan has got an interesting point here. I was recently bitten by a dog, didn't know what to do. 111 advised me to attend a minor injuries unit, which I had no idea existed. Received great care, but it saved me attending any. How come we don't know these things exist?
They exist everywhere. So we're developing a more standardized approach to that, and they're called urgent treatment centers. But in my patch, we still have minor injury units. Access to them is actually mainly through 111. So if you have an injury, like a wrist injury or a dog bite, is a good example, and it's not severe enough to need hospital attention, you'll be referred directly by 111 into these units. And they have what they call a directory of service. So they, when they assess you, it'll come out with a directory of what services exist in your local area that's nearest to you and most appropriate for your care. It's really difficult because if the public knew everything about everything that existed, I think it would add to confusion. And you wouldn't know whether to go here, there, or, yeah. So what would be great is if we, we're in a digital world now, aren't we? And actually some A&Es, you talk to me about what happens when you walk into A&E and you see a receptionist. There are some A&Es that have a digital front door. So when you go in, there is an iPad and you put all your details into the iPad, then they triage you. One example is the Homerton Hospital in London have a completely iPad-led service. You have a choice if you don't want to use it.
So you're having a heart attack and you have to put in all this stuff?
No. It's a very good question. If you're having a heart attack, they still have the receptionist and the ability to say, I'm struggling to breathe, or but for the majority of people, they can just go through an iPad and then it triages you and your information gets put into the computer system.
Tell us about, I think we're leading naturally onto it, about the NHS app that came into its own during the COVID thing, but is now, is it a platform that all our medical records can be shared all over the country?
Yes, and I think we're not in a state. I think one day we'll be in a state where it's absolutely the same for every person in every area of the country, but it's still some variability in it. Now, it's an incredible platform. It's very secure. So when you first register with the app, you have to use your passport and you have to prove that you are you, which makes it really, really secure. So when you ring the service like 111, they have to confirm you're ringing about yourself or your child. The app does it for you because it's all there. And as you said, during the pandemic, it was the only way you could travel was using the app because you had to have proof of your vaccination status. So what was great is it went from a very small niche kind of thing that people could download just to being kind of front and center for people because if they really wanted to travel, they had to have the NHS app. So I think utilizing that has been quite useful. So for instance, I had my daughter had tonsillitis and I knew what she needed. I knew exactly what the problem was. So I went onto the NHS app and it gives you a choice of communicating with your own GP. So I said, I pressed the button for that. And then it asked me all the questions, all the sort of triage questions. And then eventually it just goes to your GP and literally a few hours later, I got an email saying there's a prescription waiting for you at the chemist.
This is brilliant, isn't it? Because we're running out of our time for our podcast. We were talking earlier about the care in the community and how the blood tests and X-rays and all that sort of stuff. Just explain what your vision is for that. Or is it here already?
Yeah, this is very important because we always think of hospitals as the only place you can get things done. If you've got an acute problem, but actually there's a lot of things we can deliver in the community. And there's a lot of services that exist now and they're becoming more and more standard in different parts of the country. So if you are in a care home, for instance, and you become acutely unwell, you develop a chest infection, you can potentially get your intravenous antibiotics in the home, the intravenous fluids in the home, and then have it. Clinicians come and see you every day until you're feeling better.
Okay. And that's working, that works and it's working now?
It works really, really well, but it's not consistent everywhere. So it's something that it will become normal, I think, in the end. But I think at the moment, it's still an inconsistent model.
You're deeply, as we've all learned, deeply sort of involved in this. You're on the front line, but you're also working at systems and embedded where you are. Give us an idea of 10, 20 years from now, how you would like to see the NHS or your section of that NHS working.
Yeah. So what I'd like to see is a consistent outcome for every episode of care. So every so if you need, if you have an acute need, you should be able to get that the answer of what to do next from home. So you wouldn't have to need to travel anywhere. So I'd want, whether you use 111 online, the NHS app, whatever it was, you got the same outcome. So if you needed a GP appointment, if you need to see someone face to face, or it could be dealt with in video, it could all be assessed from home. And if you need the next level of care, if you have a diagnostic need, for instance, so you need blood tests, then they could come to your home and they could do that. But if the answers aren't possible from that process, then the next step is to get that person to hospital. And the decision is, do they need to go now, or can it wait till tomorrow morning? Or, can it be done in a more sort of planned way? So it's a constantly, so it's not a confusing process for the public. And also the outcomes are consistent. So everybody gets the right outcome. You end up in the right place first time, which is you hear that a lot in the NHS.
And that would also, would it not, bring the concept of keeping yourself as healthy as possible in your home much more alive? So if the tests are taking place in your home, or the whatever's taking place in your home, then the home is not separate from the hospital, because so many people go to the hospital, come back home.
If you're in a hospital bed, quite often all your care is in that bed. So you'll get food brought to your bed. Your toilet might even be brought to your bed in some circumstances. And your deconditioning is every day. You become weaker and weaker. If you're at home and you have the same level of care that you get in hospital, but you have your own, you're able to, you know your environment, you know the chairs that you can hold on to when you're trying to walk around, you're comfortable in your own environment. You're much more likely to stay healthy, to get mobile quicker, to get up and get better quicker. I think that's the advantage of the home. And I think that we've always had that kind of home first mentality, but it's really hard to sort of express it and explain it to people how important it is. So many years ago, I think, we get patients coming to A&E with bags, expecting to be admitted to hospital, saying, I've come in and I've got my suitcase, I think we're in a different environment now. I think people generally, they don't want to be in hospital. They hear all the bad things about hospitalization, wrong medications and falls, etc. And they want to be at home. And I think that people have that expectation now, that they just want to get treated and get home as quickly as possible, which is great.
And then that strand of keeping healthy and being health aware at home. Our time's winged chariot is upon us for our podcast recordings, so we have to close. For our live recordings, stay with us, because you will be talking directly to James. Catch our latest Goldster Magazine show podcasts. So the latest one is with the amazing Kendra Q. Dodd, who tells us how to make our voices heard. Yes, that's including the voices of NHS patients. Please email concierge@goldster.co.uk for any comments, complaints, questions, and praises, of course. We accept those. Until next week, stay safe, stay positive, stay active, be generous, and of course, stay Goldster. Thank you all for being here. And thank you, James Ray, for guiding us through that labyrinth on healthcare that we all love so much. A great Goldster conversation. You've been listening to a Goldster Magazine show podcast. Check us out on www.goldster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Goldster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.